James Church's play is a sermon I preached about 20 years ago or so, maybe longer. And it was inspired by Eric Burns' book, which is still worth reading. Go back it so you'll have a lot of fun reading it. And without getting into too much of his theory, which would be a distraction for tonight, he just points out that so many of our interactions as human beings are transactional in a very debilitating and almost perverse way. And he gives cute little names to the games, like one is called If It Weren't For You. And the wife, well, if it weren't for you, I would have gone to law school. If it weren't for you, I'd have learned how to ballroom dance. If it, well, and the husband, and finally that with the way the husband breaks that, it goes, well, go learn how to ballroom dance. It's okay. And, but of course we find out that the wife married somebody that would keep her down. And so she would never have to attempt anything she might fail at. And, a game that we play all the time, and especially if you watch, cable news, is the game Ain't It Awful, where you have two people kind of assuming the role of condescending parents looking at a situation and going tisk, 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 and never really addressing any solutions. It's very satisfying for them to, just assume this role of a high and mighty critic. And so these are games churches play. The very first game that I talk about tonight is the first one that I really identified and I've always used to introduce the concept of game playing. And remember that game playing in human relationships can be detrimental, is detrimental to us living as full humans. And game playing in churches distracts us from what I believe to be the only two reasons we exist. And that is to advance the Great Commission and to help people in need. I'm hard pressed, after 3 decades of doing this to find really another reason for the church to exist. Everything we do is ancillary to that. And yet, that's a really hard thing to do and can be uncomfortable. So it's much more satisfying to play games. So without further ado, that first game I call Don't Tell Father. And the way it works is, someone will go in the hospital. I don't want to be accused that I'll pick on a man. So Mr. Pappas goes in the hospital and people come to see him and they go, oh, you know, how long are you going to be? And he goes, I don't know, maybe, you know, a few days. And they go, well, let me tell Father so he can visit you. And he goes, well, no, don't tell Father. He's much too busy. And somebody else comes in. Well, it's better to, you know, let me give Father a call. Oh, don't tell Father. He's much too busy. And then, of course, Mr. Pappas gets discharged from the hospital and he goes, you know, I was in the hospital for 5 days and that priest never came to see me. And that's the game, Don't Tell Father. And if you're a priest on the call and you've ever been a victim of that, then you can just kind of nod and smile. But that's ultimately, it's aggravating to us priests, but it's a benign game compared to some of the other games. Another game that I identified early on is called The Good Old Days. And with The Good Old Days, people have this idealized notion of the time when the church was just perfect. Maybe it was 1970 in Atlanta or 1961 in Chicago or 1948 in Boston or even some time we never lived before, like 18th century Russia. If we could just go back to those good old days. And of course, there are no good old days. And I mean, you know, if we go back in time, we have to accept everything else that goes along with going back in time. You have to go back to a time when there were no cell phones or other modern conveniences. But every time I embark on that metaphorical time machine, it distracts me from living in the present, which is where I need to be, and dealing with the church of right now. Not the church of the right now. I think that's in suburban Atlanta, but just the church of right now. And so that's the good old days. And I have seen that played out so many times. You know, Father, our basketball league was so good in 1972. Okay. Yeah, that's cool, but it's like 1998 now. So I don't know. What do I do about that? All right. Another game. They're ruining the church. And who are they? Well, it's, you know, whatever they you want it to be. The converts, they're ruining the church. The Greeks, they're ruining the church. the hyper religious are ruining the church, you know, and we can label all these people and they just become very, very, convenient scapegoats for us. And obviously every time I use the words they're ruining the church, it's really only, I who's ruining the church. And then, one more game that before we maybe just come up for air for a second, there are plenty more to talk about tonight. And that's the game that's not orthodox. And what one discovers is that people living as Orthodox Christians in America, even though we have all these modern conveniences and we can travel and learn about things, we tend to be rather provincial and parochial with regard to our worldview of church. And so we really don't know that there's a diversity of practices in Orthodoxy. You know, a very obvious one is kneeling on Sunday. That's not Orthodox. The canons prohibit that. And people will say that boldly and everything. And it's, and as I've written about elsewhere, I remember being at a monastery in Romania on a Sunday for an outdoor liturgy. It's a very, very, very famous monastery. And they knelt three times during liturgy on Sunday. And this was, with, you know, a couple thousand people in attendance at this liturgy. And, no, you know, it was just part of their regular practice. And so we have to be very careful when we start using those words. That's not orthodox. In fact, once we understand that there's a diversity of expression and different traditions, and if we are somewhat grounded in our own theology, then we could actually critically make that statement about certain behaviors or statements. But whether or not a woman wears a scarf on a Sunday at one church and not another, or how people use their crowns at a wedding, we have to be very careful about saying that's not orthodox. Really what we're saying there is that's just not what I'm used to. All right. The next game. Children are the future of our parish. This is something that I have slipped up and succumbed to this game off and on over the years myself. And we say, well, the parish's number one priority should be vibrant youth programs. And the adults focus on developing the best possible youth ministry in Sunday school and don't pay much attention to their own spiritual growth. Because it's the children are the future. And they might even go off and hire a youth director. But they don't really know what they want the youth director for. It's kind of like a kid getting a puppy. And then nothing really changes with youth ministry because the adults don't even know why they're in church or what the church is for. And ultimately then, you know, I see this played out, you know, before where you have a youth director who comes aboard and he's all on fire for Jesus. And they say, what is wrong with that new youth director? The dance programs are worse than they've ever been. And what's wrong? The basketball team isn't winning. And so, so how do we, you know, as you've seen all these games, there's a way to stop playing them. And these are words I wish I had said them originally, but they're not. They're from a friend of mine. Children are the future of somebody else's parish. They're not the future of your parish. They're going to move. They're not the future to your parish. And if we want to have vibrant youth programming, then we need to have a parish that's filled with spiritually renewed adults. And that is the key. That is the key because then we know why we have youth ministry in the first place. And when people, I'm working with a parish now that's going through transition, and it's a parish of adults and rather older. They I don't know what they'll be like in a generation. And you know, the concern is, oh, we don't have children. We don't have enough children. Okay. Well, I got that. That's the church you are right now. And remember, and this is something again that we need to keep telling ourselves is that Islam grows through procreation. And I think they're still the fastest growing religion through procreation. Historically, theologically, biblically, Christianity grows through evangelism. And when it comes to evangelism, I'm fairly certain we're still the fastest growing religion. And so if we want good youth ministry, then go out and create a parish, a growing parish of committed adults, and then vibrant youth ministry will necessarily follow, and God will send you the children that you need to raise up when you're ready for them. And I confess, I have fallen victim to that so many times. Those of you who have known me for a long time, and I'm proud I did all these things, and I'm glad I did them. They were necessary, but I was so involved in summer camps, so involved in putting on retreats, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. All good stuff. But unless you have the spiritual underpinning in a parish, it's got very, very shallow roots. Another game has a scandalous title, but it's not scandalous. Well, it is scandalous, but for another reason. It's called Adults Only. And what happens is adults don't understand liturgy. They feel uncomfortable in liturgy. It's boring for them, et cetera. So it must be bad for kids. But so here's how you fix it. Here's how you teach people how to be comfortable in liturgy is you send them out of liturgy so they can learn. And so now they're separated completely from liturgy, which makes sense to us as adults because we really don't like it anyway. It's kind of like, nah. And so then we send them to quote unquote learn, except that the central pedagogical experience for Orthodox Christians is worship. And everything else emanates from there. And I know that, you know, even her group, I'm sure I've talked about that a gazillion times. And so adults need to get over their own discomfort and raise up children who are comfortable in liturgy. I know why they're uncomfortable. It's because even if they came as kids, they missed probably 2/3 or 3/4 of liturgy because they were in Sunday school. And so we need to break that cycle. And I have seen, you know, anecdotally through my own children and now through my grandchildren, that if you start bringing kids to church from the time they're 40 days on, that it just becomes second nature to who they are. And I would add one of my late mother-in-law's favorite aphorisms was that she wanted her children to be so comfortable in church that they could enter with the lights out and find the light switch, which I really like. Another game is this is the way people pop in and out. It's like these it's like Blair Witch Project or something, you know, but I'm trying to concentrate here. Another game is I call perfect attendance. And I don't know how it happened, but we got really, really, really wrapped up in taking attendance and counting numbers. Now in our parish, for kids who have 3 absences or less, we pay for their summer camp. But, you know, you've got you've got churches that have a reward system. You know, you have to go to X number of Sunday school classes to be able to participate in this event, et cetera. Okay, great. But then we somehow substitute checking off attendance boxes for actual Christian formation. I'm very certain that every adult sitting on this call can identify at least one person that they know that got their perfect attendance pin when they graduated Sunday school. And then poof, we just lost them. We just disappeared. And, a clergy lady, Steve Cristoforo made the statement that, you know, we need to make sure that we raise Christians and not Goyans, because what's a Goyan after Goya? It's a very good statement. And obviously we need to make sure that we raise up Christians and not Sunday school attendees, no matter how good their attendance is. And the way we start breaking that game is to stress the importance of worship, sacramental participation, have programs that develop relationships, that have Christian role models. And then also, we were talking a bit about Hangman, and as efficacious as Hangman might be, actually hands-on activities and participatory discussions lead to much better results than just counting attendance. And you really can't ultimately evaluate the efficacy of your program with an attendance book. And I have, again, participated in discussions where, you know, somebody go, we have 227 children in our Sunday school. But then on Sunday morning, they got this church that's really kind of small. There are no kids in it. What's up with that? All right. Another game is a newer one, but it's the product of a discussion I had with a young adult in the parish who gave me some great insight. And I call this one seeker friendly. And those of us who are fans of mega churches, and we know all about the seeker service. But you know, even before there were seeker services, we played this game that somehow we have to have liturgy that appeals to visitors. And that's a nice notion, except that historically, we all are aware that the only time that non-baptized people in the ancient church were there was when they stood in the narthex to hear the scripture and the sermon and then be prayed over, that they were sent out, I hope, to be instructed. But liturgy ultimately was never an evangelical tool. So how did the church grow? Well, we know the church grew through the example of believing Christians, through the witness of believing Christians. How do churches grow today? That's a whole other discussion, but we know that a large component of integrating people into the parish is getting them involved in one of the outreach ministries, small groups, et cetera. But you know, and I know that there are people who come to liturgy for the first time and it just knocks their socks off, but it didn't knock their socks off because we made it easy for them or somehow tried to dumb it down. We kept to the grandeur of it, and that's what knocked their socks off. But we break the seeker-friendly game by understanding that the way we go out and evangelize is not to try to build a better liturgy, although I'm very pro building a better liturgy, but the way we go out and do it is develop relationships, invite people, get them involved with small groups, etc. One game that I have never understood, I continue not to understand it, and my disclaimer here is I speak a number of languages, but it's this idea that there's a mystical language and that it is really cool and transforming to go to church and not understand what's being said because I don't know why. This touches the heart somehow. To go to church and not understand what's being said. And I go here in San Francisco at the Holy Virgin Cathedral a lot, where St. John is. And, you know, so much of what they do is in Old Church Slavonic. And I'm absolutely certain that even the Russian people are just catching just a smattering of what's going on. And so my only response when people say that is, I mean, I just kind of go, what? I don't even know what to say to that. But this idea that not understanding what's going on in church leads to a more mystical experience. Someone will have to explain that to me. A game we've been playing in the past decade or so, especially, is We Know Better. And we play We Know Better the following way. It's, well, look, we got iPhones, man. And we got the internet. And, I've even got a car I can plug in and charge up. So, you know, we must be smarter than the two millennia of Christians who came before us. And we know a lot. Because we know better, I can look at what the church has done for 2,000 years and say, oh, that's because they were ignorant. Thank goodness we're so smart. And so we make these decisions to change things in the church, somehow assuming that the 2,000 years of Christians that came before us were ignorant and unenlightened and clueless. And the way to cure oneself of that is to go back and read, even in translation, read the church fathers. Look at their reasoning. Look at their use of language. And consider really how shallow our reasoning is by and large and how primitive our use of language is, because all of us who know language know that it keeps getting simpler and simpler and dumber and dumber. And you know, this And if you had people who came before us who, it's like any great issue that we debate, do we think we're the first people that have ever debated it? But the people who came before us actually lived in an era in which people did talk to each other. They talked extensively and they wrote and they fought and they discussed. I've said many times, thank God that Jesus was incarnate when he was, because the people who came after him could actually take the record of scripture, could explicate it and lay it out in such a way that 2,000 years later, we get it. And, you know, if Jesus were incarnate today, he'd be in the news cycle for like 8 hours. That'd be it. Maybe somebody put a meme on the internet and that would be the end of it. You know, if you haven't seen the movie Idiocracy, see it. It's the dumbest and most clever movie ever made, but don't tell anybody a priest told you to see it. Another game, and this is near and dear to me since I have a broad demographic, including a fair number of seniors. The game's called Senior Discount. And here's what happens. I say, you know, Father, I'm retired. I've done my bit. It's up to the younger people to serve the church. And this is wrong. I know people in their eighth decade that will drive to Tahoe for the week, you know, for the weekend. I mean, they're doing everything. You know, people are living younger longer, and so we need the wisdom and the efforts of older parishioners. You don't get to opt out. You can retire from your job, but you don't retire from being a member of the body of Christ. And so until people get to the point where their brains and bodies are just breaking down, you don't get exempted from being a Christian. A game that I keep kind of coming back to, and it's appealing, but I gave it an ugly name just so I could remember that it's not appealing. And I call it navel gazing. And I, you know, people say the church exists so that I have a place to find peace and solace. Well, it does, but it exists for many more reasons than that. But it's like, don't preach those sermons. They make me uncomfortable. You know, all week long, I'm uncomfortable. I want to come here for peace and quiet. And, you know, that I don't see that anywhere in scripture. Those of us who know scripture, realize that as well. I mean, and the church doesn't exist to make me feel comfortable and peaceful. In fact, if I look at the condition of my own soul, if I look at the condition of the church in America, quite frankly, if I look at the condition of the world, I should feel rather uncomfortable. And all of us know the great preacher's cliche that the church exists to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. A game you see more in the Southeast. You don't see it in California because Californians really don't know what the Bible is. But in the Southeast, there's a game called Bible Danger. And Bible Danger is, don't read the Bible on your own. You might misunderstand something in there. And then what'll happen? You know, great, there's much more danger in not reading the Bible than perhaps misunderstanding something, because theoretically, if one is reading the Bible as a member of the church, then you're hearing it explained during sermons, but also you can pick up your phone and call the priest if there's something you don't understand. And I think I can speak for all priests when I would say that we're not very fond of the 8 a.m. phone call Saturday morning that says you misspelled my cousin's name in the bulletin. But when somebody calls up and, you know, and says it's, you know, 11 o'clock in the morning and on a Thursday, and they go, Father, I was reading my Bible and I had a question. Well, first you have to pick yourself up off the floor, but then it's like, yeah, let's talk about it. That's great. But there is the reading the Bible is not dangerous. So don't let anybody tell you that. If anybody wants to argue with me, they can call me offline about that. I'm not advocating, by the way, that you go off and start a church, or, you know, a Protestant church or something like that. A game I've watched going on for a long time is House in Order. And House in Order just says, hey, we can't go out and attract new members. We can't sponsor mission teams. We can't do any mission work. You know why? Because our parish isn't perfect. But, well, okay, so I'm waiting for the parish to be perfect. You know, that's going to happen never. But the more mission work I do, the better I become as a person, but also as a parish. Mission work makes us better. So if you want to get your house in order, go out and do the right things, and you'll get your house in order a lot quicker than if you just sit there and think about it. Another game I have is inspired by a parish that Presbyteta and I served for a long time. We stopped doing this, but we used to have lovely dinners for the parish council. But they treated it as, the name of this next game, a drop-in. And I don't know if they have drop-ins in California, but they're big back east. And a drop-in is just, there's a party and you pop in for a while and say hi, shake a few hands, grab some hors d'oeuvres, whatever. Maybe bring the host a bottle of wine, you clear out. And it's really a bummer if you've prepared filet mignon for 7 or 10 or 12 people. And then people come in like 3 hours later. Oh, I didn't know this was a dinner. Well, drop-in is a game we play with church, right? Because how do we treat things at church, including and especially worship and everything else, right? It's an open house. So yeah, I'll come by later if I have time. Yeah, I'll drop by. I'll shake a few hands. I'll check in with God, check in with the peeps and, say how great it's to be here. You know, if you're there for the sermon, you can always, hey, Padre, great sermon. But you know, liturgy is not a drop-in. It's a banquet. And we've all heard that. But liturgy is that filet mignon dinner you prepared for 12 people and half the people thought it was a drop-in. And remember, those of us who know anything about ancient liturgy, we know that the liturgy started only after the faithful were assembled. The faithful assembled. Then came the bishop and the presbyters and they entered church together, to all have that banquet together. Another game I've been hooked into many times is the game Make America Orthodox, which is a great way for us to blame other people, especially our hierarchs. You know, if it weren't for the Assembly of Canonical Orthodox Bishops, we'd be a lot closer. If it weren't for Patriarch so-and-so, if it weren't for this. And so it's if it weren't for our history in America. But we have to go out and make America Orthodox. As I heard somebody say 25 years ago, it's still true, is, you know, can the culture that invented microwave popcorn actually embrace Orthodoxy in a broad scale? I don't know. But the best thing that I can do if I want to make America Orthodox is to make myself as Orthodox as possible by practicing the faith. I have direct control over how I practice my faith. And as a priest, I have a fair amount of influence about how my faithful live their faith. So make America Orthodox. Yeah, we'll start with yourself and start with the church and God can take care of the rest, but stop blaming other people for it. There's a game that I call We Didn't Expect That. I have also entitled it from time to time, Not So Great Expectations. But the way that gets played is we don't make any expectations for anybody. We're afraid to. We might hurt their feelings. At summer camp, you know, we're afraid to go up to, you know, some little girl, you know, obviously you don't do it as a guy, you tell a girl or a woman counselor, but you're afraid to go say, honey, could you cover up, please? Because, you know, God forbid we would hurt her feelings. And, you know, with her mom and dad in church, we don't make any, it's like, well, you know, fasting's kind of a personal thing. Okay. Oh, you know, come to liturgy. Don't come to liturgy, et cetera. We don't make any expectations on people. And remember that the first step in ancient catechism, all of us have read, is you sat down with the bishop and the bishop said, here's what's expected of a Christian. And I've discovered now that I am getting, you know, and I told the parishes a few weeks ago, I'm going through my cranky old man stage, but as I've actually started placing expectations and more expectations on people in a loving way, and I mean easy expectations like come to church on time, come to church regularly, but it works out pretty well. And if we think about everything that's laid out for us in the history of the faith and in scripture, there's a whole lot of expectations in there, but the expectations make us better and they make our life richer. They give us that life in abundance. So the way to stop having not so great expectations is to lay out some expectations. This is a game that probably most lay people won't appreciate as priests do. And I call the game question and answer. And I haven't had to play it in a while because I abandoned a long, long time ago the old timey Bible study. We do small groups that don't involve me at all except to just smile. But you know, the old timey Bible study. You're sitting there and the priest is in the front and he's reading and he goes, and maybe it's a study on, Genesis, comparing the two creation stories and then looking at the fall and all the implications of the whole story of the fall with the tree of the knowledge of good and evil and the serpent and blah, 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 blah. And you finish that whole thing and whatever. And, you know, of course there's the same 15 people there last week and it'll be there next week, but that's cool. All right. And you finish all that and okay, any questions? And now this is why it's called question and answer. It's yes, you and back there. And it's like, Father, how often should I receive communion? It's like, what? What were we talking about for the past hour? And then I've even seen it where I've had people ask questions, see people ask questions of a priest. The priest is talking about the theology of the Trinity or goodness knows what. And somebody says, are husbands and wives supposed to be intimate on Saturday night? It's like, holy cow, where did that come from? And the, you know, the way that you work around that is real simple, which is if somebody's got a question on how often they should receive communion or anything else, it's like, I always say, ask the priest you see for confession. He'll tell you. And, if somebody goes, well, I don't go to confession, it's like, well, why are you asking questions about communion? Don't go to, like, you should be going to communion anyway. But, that's not only a way to kind of stop those questions, but I think it's actually a rather constructive answer. And if, again, if you're a priest, you've been through that too. You know, you go through, you get these questions that are just out of left field, unrelated. And I'm not even sure they're always necessarily have the best governing values behind them, but I can't say that for sure. A game that we play with ourselves as Americans are too busy to pray, too busy to worship regularly. Goodness gracious, I've got too much going on. Okay. So think about historically the times that the church existed. You had people who were in agrarian society that were up early feeding the animals. You had foreign invasions. You had plagues. You had, I mean, you know, if you think it's a bummer when your cell phone battery starts to go low, imagine what happens when your well dries up and you got to go walk three miles for water. And yet somehow the people back then were able to sustain the faith such that we have it today. So any American who says that he or she is too busy to pray or practice the faith or something like that, it is absolute self-delusion. Three more games for those of you who are still awake. One is I call compline, and this comes directly from my work with other churches. So the church is in trouble, whatever it is. Membership is down or money's off or goodness knows what. And without actually critically understanding what to do to try to approach the problem, we come up with a brilliant answer, which is what? We just need to do more evening services because that's what Orthodox do. And so you have a parish that really would benefit from home visits and phone calls and developing relationships. And yet what happens is the leadership bands together and says, yes, we need to do, we'll do compline three nights a week, and that's going to bring the people back. And the response to the game of compline is just examine the church and figure out what tack you're going to take to try to get where you want to be. And part of that, by the way, is worship and integrating it into the whole program. But just doing services on their own, I have never, ever, ever seen it work. And even as you know, those of you who've been to Orthodox countries, when you go to those evening services, they're not exactly standing room only. The second to last game is called Wishful Thinking. And Wishful Thinking is a game that's really been foisted upon me many times as a priest. And I'll get a big old binder in the mail. This is back in the days before there was the internet. Big old binder of a program. We're filling the program. It's a youth program, God knows what. And do this program. And I say big old, I'm talking a, you know, 3-inch binder. And you look at it and you can tell that it's kind of meh. And they ask the question, have you tried this with anyone? No. What do you mean no? you did this whole big program, you reproduced it, sent it out, and you, with the hopeful expectation it would work, why didn't you try it first? So the way around wishful thinking is do a little bit of empiricism before you spend all that money and try out some things. And those of you who, you know, we've talked professionally, you know, I'm big on trying new stuff. If it doesn't work, then stop doing it. And if it does work, you're onto something. But just adopting something carte blanche because it just seems like a good thing to do is again, somewhat delusional. And then finally, is the game called Silver Bullet. And with Silver Bullet, it's like, this one program is going to change our church, whatever it happens to be. We're going to go out and we're going to, as a parish council, we're going to visit every parish home in the next 3 years. Or we're going to start a blank and blank ministry or blah, whatever it is. There are no silver bullets. Everything begins and ends with the sacraments and traditional piety. And then you add the programs as a way of helping people get incorporated into the life of the sacraments and of worship and traditional piety. Holy Communion and Living Communion with Jesus is the beginning and end of everything we do. So when somebody comes to town, like the guy from Music Man, and he's standing there and saying, this is the program. It's like, you know, we got the program. You know, just give me something that might help out with that program. And so there's no big finish. That's the end of all my games.